Right then, settle in, because we're about to take a proper look at how the sands of historical reputation can shift beneath our feet. As that clever chap Leonardo da Vinci put it, la verità fu sempre solo figlia del tempo. Truth, you see, is always the daughter of time.
Exactly. And it's precisely this evolving understanding of the past that draws us to our subject today.
Right.
We're plunging into Peter Schultz's Lucullus Herrschen Griesen in der späten Römischen Republik, a work which offers a rather compelling reappraisal of a figure often relegated to a footnote.
Yeah, painted as little more than a caricature of Roman excess, usually.
That's it. Our exploration today is very much informed by Clemens Lynchinger's astute review, whose assessment of the book's merits we wholeheartedly concur with.
Absolutely. Our mission today, for your discerning ears, is to unpack this fresh perspective on Lucius Licinius Lucullus, a fellow who lived from, 118 to 56 BCE?
That's right.
Cast aside for a moment the traditional image of the outrageously indulgent aristocrat, what Schultz's work reveals is a rather different kettle of fish.
A remarkably capable military strategist, for one.
And a governor in the East who was, by all accounts, rather popular, surprisingly enough.
What's particularly striking, wouldn't you agree, is the book's argument that Lucullus rather astutely recognized the seemingly irreversible decline of the Republic quite early on.
Yeah, he saw the writing on the wall, so to speak.
Faced with this rising tide of, autocracy, he made a conscious decision to withdraw from the political hurly-burly.
And cultivate a life of private, albeit undeniably luxurious, pleasure.
Yes. And it's jolly important to remember that this negative portrayal of him, the chap, as degenerate nobleman, was largely cooked up by his political rivals.
No, definitely. And those who, shall we say, had a vested interest in legitimizing the autocratic regimes that followed the Republic.
Nasty business, politics, even back then.
True.
What's rather fascinating, as the review so rightly points out, is that the struggles faced by the late Roman Republic bear some, rather unsettling resemblances to the sorts of challenges that democratic processes grapple with even today.
It's a connection that lends a real layer of contemporary resonance to this historical deep dive, wouldn't you say?
It really does.
Right then, let's get down to brass tacks, shall we? Schultz dedicates the opening chapter of his book to a concise history of the Republic's ascent, and crucially, it slides into division.
Mm-hmm. And it's a section that's incredibly valuable for grasping the underlying reasons for the whole edifice coming a cropper.
You really need that background.
Indeed. Yeah. One must appreciate that the Roman Republic wasn't a carbon copy of the Athenian model of democracy.
Not at all. Unlike in the Greek assemblies, ordinary Roman citizens didn't have the direct ability to stand up and propose legislation themselves, did they?
No, they didn't. Instead, as Schultz meticulously lays out, the Roman Republic functioned as a senatorial aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
Power was heavily concentrated within the Senate.
Right. And this system was underpinned by a pervasive network of what we might call clientelist relationships, the famous patroni and clientes.
Think of it a bit like a pyramid scheme of favors and obligations, almost, where powerful patrons supported their clients in exchange for loyalty and, crucially, political support.
And membership in the Senate was for life, but crucially, it was contingent on having previously held a significant magistracy.
Correct. And these magistracies, positions such as consul, praetor, and censor, were typically held for just a year.
A very short term.
Which meant constant competition. Initially, the plebeians, the farmers, artisans, and laborers were at a significant political disadvantage, particularly when it came to holding these higher offices.
Their struggle for greater political clout is a key narrative of the Republic's earlier history.
That struggle eventually led to the establishment of the office of the People's Tribune.
Ah, yes, the tribunes. Vital.
This was a vital development, as the tribune wielded the power of veto, allowing them to block the decisions of the Senate or other magistrates if they deemed those decisions to be unjust to the plebeians.
It became a rather effective safeguard against the dominance of the patrician class, for a while at least.
So for a considerable period, this delicate balance of power between the Senate, the magistrates, and the people contributed to the Republic's stability.
But there's always a but.
Well, exactly. As Schultz details, the relentless military expansion and the subsequent influx of slaves from conquered territories created rather profound social and economic inequalities.
Huge inequalities. The sheer number of slaves undercut the livelihoods of small Roman farmers, didn't it? Creating this dispossessed urban population.
Precisely. Ripe for political unrest. This widening gulf between the haves and have-nots fundamentally destabilized the Republic's social fabric.
We see this rather vividly in the story of the Gracchi brothers, Tiberius and Gaius, who, as people's tribunes, fought tooth and nail for crucial land reforms.
And the Senate's fierce resistance to these efforts really underscores the growing internal conflict within the Republic.
It's a classic example of entrenched power digging in its heels, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And Schultz recounts a truly extraordinary event. Senators physically attacking the populace and even a tribune.
Unthinkable previously.
This violent breakdown of established norms underscores just how far the Republic had descended into internal strife. It's not the sort of reasoned political discourse one might expect.
No.
This fierce opposition and the unwillingness to compromise unfortunately marked a further descent into internal conflict, culminating in truly shocking events.
Absolutely. And Schultz really excels at presenting this complex history in a remarkably accessible way.
He does.
Clearly demonstrating the interconnectedness of these events and how they inevitably led to the erosion of the Senate's authority. He manages to make what could be dry as dust feel rather gripping.
Agreed. Turning our attention now to Lucullus himself. The biography dedicates significant attention to his military achievements.
Right, particularly his campaigns against Mithridates VI of Pontus.
And his governance of the Greek cities in Asia Minor that came under Roman control.
It's worth noting that Sulla, a towering figure in the late Republic, held Lucullus in high esteem.
Yes, viewing him as a loyal and highly capable general.
But perhaps even more telling is Lucullus's reputation among the conquered Greek populations. They actually revered him as a benefactor.
Which is quite something. This positive regard stemmed from Lucullus's firm stance against the Roman tax farmers and the war profiteers.
The publicani, yes. Always looking to squeeze the provinces dry.
Exactly. Those who sought to exploit these newly acquired territories through exorbitant taxes and ruthless extraction of wealth, he actively worked to protect the Greek cities from such predation.
It's rather commendable, wouldn't you say? Good governance versus outright exploitation.
Very much so. Indeed, the Greeks held him in such high esteem that they erected monuments in his honor.
Which stands in stark contrast to the animosity he faced from the Roman moneyed aristocracy, the Equites.
Understandably displeased from their perspective by his rather lenient treatment of these valuable conquered lands. You can almost hear their grumbling.
Definitely, they wanted their cut.
The book then delves into the political machinations that ultimately undermined Lucullus. A key episode involves the betrayal by Publius Clodius Pulcher.
Ugh. Clodius, the rather notorious brother of Lucullus's wife, Clodia.
That's the one. Clodius, driven by his own political ambitions, instigated a mutiny within Lucullus's ranks while he was still on campaign. A thoroughly underhanded tactic.
Deplorable. And upon his return to Rome, Lucullus didn't hesitate to divorce Clodia, publicly accusing her of adultery.
And the rumors at the time, quite scandalously, suggested her affair was with none other than her own brother, Clodius.
One can only imagine the gossip columns of ancient Rome buzzing with that tidbit. Juicy stuff.
Indeed. Lucullus was eventually granted a triumph for his military successes, but even this was delayed for several years.
Which must have been galling, a significant and rather humiliating wait for a victorious general seeking to celebrate his achievements.
A clear sign of the political headwinds he was facing.
Definitely. Schultz also paints a rather vivid picture of Lucullus's life after his enforced withdrawal from politics.
Far from being impoverished, he'd clearly profited from his time in office.
Let's say monetized his time.
Huh. Yes, perhaps. And transformed his private life into an extravagant spectacle of Roman luxury and refined living.
His lavish villas, complete with elaborate gardens, fish ponds stocked with exotic species, and aviaries filled with rare birds, became legendary.
And rather shrewdly, he turned this into a business, selling these exotic creatures to other wealthy Romans.
One has to admire the entrepreneurial spirit, even if it was a bit over the top.
Quite. In this way, Lucullus rapidly became the very epitome of sophisticated taste and conspicuous consumption.
If you wanted to demonstrate your wealth and discernment, you paid a visit to Lucullus and naturally acquired something from his impressive collection.
A sort of ancient celebrity endorsement, if you will.
Exactly. But, as Schultz compellingly argues, this very lifestyle was then weaponized by his political adversaries.
Figures like Caesar, Pompey, and Crassus, and later by the autocratic rulers.
They used his opulent existence to portray him as a symbol of decadent excess.
Conveniently positioning themselves as virtuous and humble servants of the public good in contrast.
A rather convenient bit of political theater.
Isn't it just?
However, the book is keen to dispel this notion of Lucullus as a mere hedonist. Schultz presents him as a ver humanis.
A man of culture, a friend to education and the arts. His deep intellectual connection with Cicero, particularly their shared passion for the Greek language and philosophy, underscores this.
Yes, that's a key point.
Indeed. Lucullus's villa housed an extensive library, which, importantly, was publicly accessible.
Not just a private collection hoarded away.
No, it wasn't merely a repository of scrolls. It was furnished for intellectual engagement, with comfortable seating and an atmosphere conducive to scholarly discourse.
And Lucullus himself was an active participant, apparently, regularly engaging in discussions with visiting intellectuals.
A true patron of the arts and sciences.
Which brings us to the intriguing detail of the Heracles statue that Lucullus commissioned.
Ah, yes, the statue. Fascinating.
As Schultz compellingly argues, this wasn't some boastful display of heroic triumph.
No, quite the opposite. Instead, it served as a rather poignant symbol of a degrading end.
Rather than depicting Heracles in his familiar guise as the victorious strongman with his club and lion skin,
Lucullus's statue portrayed the demigod in his final agonizing moments, close to his own funeral pyre. He's depicted suffering, poisoned by the tunic given to him by his wife,
who mistakenly believed it to be a love potion. The reality, of course, was that the tunic was soaked in the poisoned blood of the centaur Nessus.
Horrific. The poison burned deep into Heracles' flesh, leaving him, the seemingly invincible hero, with no escape other than to seek release in the flames.
It was only in death, according to the myth, that he was finally granted divine honor and elevated to immortality by Zeus. A rather grim tale, all told.
Very grim. As Schultz elucidates, this unconventional choice of subject matter wasn't simply a display of Lucullus's unique character and extravagant taste.
No, it was deeper than that.
More profoundly, it was a powerful and deeply personal expression of his own suffering and his profound disappointment at his premature recall from his command in the war against Mithridates.
A subtle but rather powerful form of protest, wouldn't you say? Using art to comment on his political fate.
Absolutely. The statue, therefore, spoke volumes about how Lucullus viewed his own situation. Undefeated in his military endeavors, yet sidelined and politically neutered through the machinations of his rivals.
And intriguingly, as Schultz notes, the public at the time seemed to grasp this meaning.
Yes, its fate after Lucullus's death repeatedly being removed and then re-erected in different locations depending on which political faction held sway suggests a clear understanding of its symbolic weight.
Rather remarkable, really, that resonance.
Now, while the review, and indeed we, find a great deal to commend in Schultz's biography, it's important to acknowledge a few nuances.
Okay, fair enough.
The book's clear aim is to rehabilitate Lucullus's image, presenting him in a largely positive light.
Right, which makes for a very readable account.
It does. But there's a sense that perhaps some of his potential flaws aren't explored in as much detail, which might leave some historians wanting a more critically distanced perspective.
A touch more balance might have been appreciated by some. That's fair.
That's a fair point. And the reviewer also touches on the book's subtitle, Herrschen und Genießen in der späten Römischen Republik.
Ruling and enjoying in the late Roman Republic.
While Lucullus is indeed famous for his opulent banquets, the book actually focuses more on his military and political career, as well as his architectural and artistic projects.
Rather than providing extensive descriptions of his culinary excesses. So those expecting a deep dive into Roman gastronomy might find themselves slightly off their main course, so to speak.
Quite. There's also a minor editorial point raised in the review, which we concur with.
The footnotes.
Yes, the footnotes restarting with each chapter, while perhaps a stylistic choice, can be a little inconvenient for those wishing to follow up on specific references.
And the lack of chapter headings in the appendix's notes section makes it a tad cumbersome to locate the corresponding sources.
Minor quibbles in an otherwise excellent work, mind you.
Agreed. Despite these minor quibbles, the overall impact of the book is rather significant. Schultz's writing style is indeed precise and engaging.
Very much so, making it accessible and enjoyable for anyone with a thirst for knowledge, regardless of their prior familiarity with the period. He really brings the era to life.
He does.
Absolutely. For historians and those with a specific interest in Roman history or military leadership, this meticulously researched work comes highly recommended.
It offers a wealth of information and insightful historical connections that truly help to illuminate the complex political and military dynamics of the late Roman Republic.
The author's portrayal of the Republic's transformation into an autocracy and the reasons behind Lucullus's historical misrepresentation are particularly noteworthy.
Definitely. And as the review so astutely concludes, this book offers valuable insights even for contemporary observers of democratic processes.
The echoes of political intrigue and the manipulation of public perception across the millennia are quite thought-provoking.
History, it seems, does have a habit of rhyming, doesn't it?
It certainly seems to. So, to summarize our deep dive today, we've explored how Peter Schultz's biography offers a significant reassessment of Lucullus,
moving beyond the simplistic image of a decadent figure
to reveal a more complex individual, a capable military leader, a popular governor, and a discerning intellectual who recognized the shifting tides of Roman politics.
We've also touched upon the book's valuable insights into the decline of the Roman Republic
and the subtle yet perhaps significant parallels to the challenges faced by democracies today. The most illuminating journey, wouldn't you agree?
Indeed. On that note, here's a final thought for you to chew over. How precisely are historical narratives constructed?
Mm-hmm.
And how often is the memory of those who oppose the eventual victors rather conveniently shaped by the very individuals who triumphed?
The crucial question. Looking at our own times, how might contemporary figures be similarly misrepresented in the future?
It certainly gives one a moment to pause and ponder the complexities inherent in historical judgment.
A vital point indeed. And we do hope this deep dive has provided you with a valuable shortcut to understanding this fascinating historical figure and the turbulent era in which he lived. Thank you for joining us.